יש הצור סך חלוקים little time and it's the field is a vast one and I'm going to try to concentrate a few thoughts in the following areas. One, something of an overview or of a survey of the background that preceded the emergence of the movement of the Hasidus of the Baal Shem Tov and his Talmidim. Next time, Mir Hashem, we'll take a look at the Gror. We're not here for a little to be done. It's only that the Baal Shem is a little bit earlier in time, and for that reason, I'm starting there. The background. Second area of concern for us is some biographical notes. The third, the outer forms of his hanhaga, how he lived, what he did, who his talmidim were, what new inyonim he brought into Klal Yisrael. And the fourth, what's most important, is the Hashkafas Olam, which either he, in most cases, or in some cases his talmidim, formulated. These several areas of concern need to be preceded by a few questions. What do we mean by a new movement, bichlal, in the world of Avda Hashem, the world of Jews, whose basis is Emunah, Kel Yochid and Miyuchad, in Gilu Shechina al Har Sinai, whose faith is Shechinas Tomim, that try to be Tmimim in our Emunah, that the Torah Kedosh Biksav, Shebal Peh, Nitna Mesinai, this Torah that we have, this is the product, this is the content of the revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to his people and to the world of Har Sinai. What room is there for anything new? Klal Zeh, we can go by. There have been a number of movements that tried, even though, you have to say parenthetically, even though even these movements that I'm going to mention in a moment, however briefly, all claimed that they stood on the ground of truth, and that they also were doing nothing more than to present in a new lavush maybe what was essential, what was eternal in the original Torah. But these movements that I'm speaking of now were guilty of negating one or another of the basic principles of the original Torah. They all became withered branches off the tree. They all vanished. Every one of them in its time made a lot of noise. And some of them at times were close to a majority. And some of them at times were so powerful in their image projection, so powerful in their psychological hold, in their organizational power, that they seem to be discrediting, at times, the greatest among our own. And yet, those that were untrue to the basic truths of Torah, they became withered branches that fell off the tree, or they fell out. Shamrenim. Litzdoikim, the Baisusim, the Karoim, those who followed Shapsa Tzvi and later Yaakov Frank, withered branches. They fell off the tree. And others fell out. Christianity. It's a spark from our fire. It's crumbs from our bread, from our table. They fell out. They tore themselves out and they were spit out. Conservatism and reform. In the case of reform, it's becoming very clear, a lot faster than we thought. They're making gasps, it's gasping noises. They're now reduced to trying to legitimize the fact that 60 or 70% of their third generation youth are intermarrying outright goyim and goyis, by legitimizing either the intermarriage directly in the name of an idiotic universalism, committing suicide, or worse. They're trying desperately to legitimize the whole sordid business with a falsification of Geirus. I don't have to spell that out anymore. But the end is clear. They're a dying branch. We don't rejoice over it. When the Frankists finally entered into apostasy, became converts to Christianity, the Baal Shem Tov wept, even though he played a major role, according to many authorities, not everybody agrees, in getting rid of him. He wept over that. And he said that the Shechina says, Kalni Meraishi, Kalni Mizroi. Shechina weeps when that happens. Because a limb, even if it's severed from the body, almost, it's almost severed, but if there's a single thread left yet that ties it to the body, there's still hope. Maybe a very remote hope. But there's still hope that there can be a healing. But once the limb is severed completely, there's no hope. So we don't rejoice over that. Don't think that that's my point. But this is a historical fact. Those who distorted the Torah became dying limbs. They fell out. They fell off from the body. Others fell out. That's one type of new movement, quote unquote. There's another kind. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Berachmav, through his Hashgacha over Klal Yisrael, sent Shlichim, who also seemed to be, first as Yechidim, then movements developed around them, who also seemed to be doing new things. If you analyze carefully what authentic Shlichim of the Hashgacha, whether Yechidim or movements, what they did, you'll find that all that they ever did, this is a klal, Baduk Menusa, was to emphasize certain aspects of the original tradition more than had been the case before. The Nevi'i Yisrael did not oppose Karbonos. They opposed the falsification of Karbonos as a substitute for Avodah Shebelev. That's what they opposed. They opposed it if it became a substitute for real Emunah and real Avodah and real Mishpat. That's when they opposed it. If you go down the Doris, I jump ahead a great deal. The Rambam B'Sayatoi, earlier, sorry, Rav Sadia Gaon, quote unquote, the great, those of the Rishonim who were Shachaltanayim, rationalists, seeming rationalists, some of them seemed to be Aristotelians and some of them seemed to be Platonists. They were not. They remained within the pantheon of Jewish glory, of Torah glory, of the Nitzchias of Klal Yisrael, because even though they used for pedagogical purposes, and because they lived in encounter worlds, in worlds where the Torah had to defend itself against violent danger or attack, and because of that, they were willing to use the cultural idiom of their time, they nevertheless, to the best of their ability, never went beyond using that cultural idiom as a lavush, as a garment. Wherever there was a clash between Aristotelianism and the Yesodos of Emunah, the Rambam said no to Aristotelians. And yet he was criticized. And yet, because so much of the Moira seems to be Aristotelian, at least in its forms, and in some of its ideas and some of its emphases, because of that, when a period came, and that challenge was already past, because Aristotelianism died in the Western world as a preeminent expression of truth. After that happened, somehow the great silent, the Neshama Klolius of Klal Yisrael said, the Moiras Kodesh Kedoshim, we don't learn him literally as a primary source. We learn him when we are mature enough and sophisticated enough in Torah learning and Torah thought and Torah experience to understand, to know that when we see a certain levush, an example, an instant example, there are hundreds of them, when we see that the Rambam speaks about the golden means, he does not mean the golden means of Aristotle. He uses that idiom. And anybody who learns Ishmael Prokin and begins to compare, begins to understand. But if a person is not mature enough to hear that and to understand that, he's going to think the Rambam is an Aristotelian. So, better, where there is so much risk to the Yesodos HaEmunah, where so much depends on the purity of Yesodos HaEmunah on the part of Tzion Kadoshim, of New Talmidim, better that shouldn't be their primary sphere, you know, of finding out what are the Yesodos HaEmunah. But the distillate of his thought, those Yud Gimel Ikrim, there can be disputes over maybe those 13 can be subsumed under three general headings, like Rabbi Yosef Albo wanted to do, and there have been other disputes over that. The Ababinel had another view. In the substance of the matter, it's there that the Rambam comes through to us, to all the generations. And Zuchain Holo. When the Zohar HaKadosh became revealed, the Havdol, the Misporam in the 1300s, we who are Shlema Emunah Yisrael would say, those of us who have no entrance into, not born beside Hashem, we have no entrance into Kabbalah. How did he put it to me once, Rav Bik, Yarech Hashem Yomav, when I asked him, Rebbe, if a person is not a Ma'amin in Kadmus HaZohar, and Zohar is an expression of Gilu Shchinah, you're not Pekoros? No, he said, Chilil, he's deeply betos, but not Pekoros, he's not, because the Chelek HaNigla Shebetorah, that's given to Klal Yisrael. The Chelek HaNista Shebetorah, if you grow up and you understand, you're going to find out, but if you're not about Barochi, you haven't entered into it, you don't know. So, an Erech Hayit is going to say about that, I have no idea. So along one day, Rabbi Yaakov Emden will come in his Mitpach HaSeifchem, and he's going to Taino that Bevada Rav Shimba Yechoy was the Mechaber of the Zohar. But significant chalokim of what we have in the Zohar today were from other sources and were somehow blended in. There's a lot of material on this. What's my point? In the thinking of all the Chachma Yisrael Amiti, in all the Doras since the Zohar appeared, the tradition that there is a Masoiris of Torah HaNisto b'Yisrael, without regard to this or that Prat, this or that Chelek of this or that Sefer, that there is such a Masoiris, and that there were times when it was an underground stream, and it was, the Hashgacha didn't feel it necessary that should become revealed to Hamoinim. And there were other times when the Hashgacha wanted the Zohar HaKadosh to appear, and the Talmud Vayera to appear, and Chayin Holo, and the Rakeach, and all of those great Sforim, and then finally, the Ari HaKodesh Begurov, and then the Baal Shem Tov on one side, and then the Gaon of Vilna on the other side. Chas v'lahaskeh to think that that was all of it, just somehow an accidental product of history, and that that was an evolutionary, not originally authentic chalik of the revelation of Torah. Again, in Pratim, this or that sefer, there's room for a lot of the discussion and debate, and the part of Chachmei Yisrael will have an entree into these inyonim. But that there is a Torah Hanista b'Yisrael, which at certain times became an organized movement and was projected on the scene because it was necessary, that's what Shlomo Emunah Yisrael believe, and there's a test. The test is this. When such a movement appears on the scene, whether it's Aristotelianism on one side, or on the other side, Torah HaKabbalah as we have it, Torah HaNisteh, the acid test is, what grows out of those movements with reference to reverence and kiyum of the halacha, of the mitzvahs Hashem aniglis. If any of those movements led or lead to a weakening of faithfulness, a faithful practice of Torah Shebal Peh, the Torah Haniglis, Shas Apaskin, if that's what happens, so we say, even if those who started it were Gedolim, we walk away from that. It happened to numbers, this I have to mention. Wherever Chachmei Yisrael felt that there might be a negative result that might flow vis-a-vis keeping the mitzvahs Hashem, vis-a-vis digda kadin, abiding by the halacha, that there might be a danger to that as a result of emphasis or spread of certain doctrines which were parts of one or another of these new tenuos, they fought it. And there were innocent victims of that. The Hisnagdus to the Rambam essentially came from that, even though it came from other sources as well. Hisnagdus to the Rambam Bechayev. You're entering into history a little bit. Permit me to say parenthetically, you're grown-ups already. Get away from the black-white business. Get away from the whole notion that we have easy answers to everything. On the Kever of the Rambam, the Nesher HaGodol, there were people who wrote, who inscribed, Poi Nitman Hamin V'Hamenuda. And because Milon HaGodol, because Rabbeinu Yonah, if we speak in the whole history of the Am Hashem, of a figure, one figure who says, whose name says Tshuva, it's the Rabbeinu Yonah. His whole name says Tshuva. The Rabbeinu Yonah wrote the Sha'arei Tshuva as an act of Tshuva because he was one of those who maligned the Rambam, who fought him hard, and when, as a result of that struggle against the Rambam, Christian clergy piled up, I'm compressing a lot here, as a result of that, when they piled up 400 wagon loads of handwritten shasen, and they burned them publicly, the Rabbeinu Yonah came to the conclusion that he was one of those guilty, and he spent the rest of his life doing tshuva for that, and that's why we have the Sha'arei Tshuva. And then others wrote on that matzeva. I don't recall which inscription came first, but we know which inscription is the final one. Poin Nitman Nufchar Min Ho'enushi. That was some debate. It wasn't black-white. But the fear was that Knesset Yisrael was afraid what will happen to the integrity of the Torah Niglis if his whole worldview remains unchallenged. The Rabbanu Shalom Klal Yisrael paskened with him, except that we would not go along with him with reference to the name that he gave his great work. He called it the Mishneh Torah. So Klal Yisrael said, Milam, nobody's greater than you. But we will call you by any number of, and we'll call you the Yad. We'll call you by other names. But we're not going to call you the Mishneh Torah. Because that's left only for Dvorim. I mean, there were two others. Also endlessly great, incomparably great. Elsheth His name of his chibur is Teras Moshe. So we say the Yalshach HaKadosh, but we won't call it Teras Moshe. And the Chassam Sofer. Chassam means Chidush HaTeras Moshe. So Kol Yisrael said, we'll make an abbreviation out of it, we'll make it Rosh HaTevis. Milona Godel with the Chassam Sofer, but we're not going to call it Teras Moshe. See, there's Kol Yisrael has a, it's a great silent veto sometimes. Al Kaponim, every movement that's essentially, that's inwardly, intrinsically true to Teiras Hashem, it has place, even though it may look like it's so revolutionary, it's so different than what came later, than what came before. It's turning the world upside down. Right? The Rambam in his day, and the Ariyah Kodesh, when that started, you know, taking over the world, there were many who thought that it has to be fought. For that reason, the Ramchal was bitterly fought. There was great fear as to what would come out of his teachings. The Hashgacha finally paskened that he was safe, and not just safe, but about him the Gaon said that he would have walked across on foot, would walk on foot to go learn Musa from him. B'chein holo, 1 second, hold a moment. This happened to Teiras HaBaal Shem Tov as well. It happened to a lesser degree to the Teiras HaMusa Miyusaydam Shereb So Salante. There can be conflict, but any one of these movements, about them we already know. There are other movements we don't know yet. But those two movements that I just mentioned, there was desperate struggle against them for a while. But precisely, in part because of that very struggle, they ended up proving to their bitterest opponents that those fears were not justified. And this is a necessary background to talking about Teiras HaBaal Shem Tov, and later, Teiras HaMusa Miyusaydam Shereb So Salante. So, bottom line, movements which seem to be responses to the challenges of new situations, but movements which were not genuine enough, were not authentically faithful to the original Teiras HaShem, they fell out. Movements which were, it ended up with Machlokes L'Shem Shemayim, Esayfa L'Hiskayim, Esvoev B'Sufo, Eilu Ve'eilu Divrei L'Kim Chayim. And we can see that in the course of time, how whenever there was a dispute that was really based only on the fact that these and those, great as they were, they could only come, without another present, they could only come to an approximation of the ultimate truth. So because of human shortcomings, they followed, to the best of their abilities, they followed the paths that with dam v'yeza, with blood and sweat and toil and tear and endless amal teira, their truth came to, and they fought hard for it. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu protected them too. So they and their opponents ended up learning from each other. That's how it ended up. And that it ended up that in such cases, there was a blend. It was a blend. There's another movement, a blend, or I should say, or a coexistence. There's another movement which has to be mentioned here, which we don't know yet. We don't know yet. Reb Shamsher Rafael Hirsch. All the Chachmei Yisrael who did not share his point of view, all of them, Kulam, they all said, Tzadik Yisrael Darlam. They didn't fight him, but they did fight some of his outlook, parts of his outlook. And they said, yeah, there it has a place, here it doesn't have a place. This needs to be known. This whole question of Torah Derecheretz, if you take it more deeply than just as a, you know, as an outer method for dealing with Western business and Western campuses, but if you take it as a worldview, as a Torah worldview, we need time yet. There's zigzags, ups and downs about that. In Eretz Yisrael today, that movement is cannot off base. It's not accepted. In America, in part, it is accepted, and in part, it's not accepted. We don't know yet. There's another world-famous name that, here, on the one hand, we would have to say, V'loi dumi yotehilo. The Gerer Rebbe said about Rav Kook, Zuchana Levrocha, that he was like a certain Tana about whom the Gemara says there was none in his generation like him, and therefore they didn't pass him like him. So he didn't share in just knocking. He didn't knock. But he held that, I once heard b'shem Rav Hutner Zechana Levracha, that it was great. He held that he was greater than any of his opponents, but at the same time, but he said like this, Matnishke Paskin Zuhir. The world didn't Paskin like him. Now, what does that mean? We're in the middle. We don't know yet. There were certain dangers that resulted from applying his thinking uncritically, applying it, for taking it from the lofty levels in which it was expressed, and trying to implement it in the here and now of contemporary Israeli institutionalism, and even before, and it led to certain negative results, and there was an instant backlash from the Torah world, and we need to know, that name is still, we don't know what the end will be with that yet. And we have to hope that Kadosh Baruch Hu, I mean, that was such a giant, such an anak, such a neshama yekara, and I say the same thing in a different way about Rav Shamshon Aviv Hirsch. Halavai that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should lead us to understand that when the right time will come, such and such will develop. But that, what do we know? You have a thought.
Yeah. There was a statement that the Rav Hu made, which I'm not sure Rav Hu said that movements that come up which tend to strengthen the kiyum, it's the acid test.
Acid test.
What exactly does Rav Hu mean? Every movement, even like the mice when it turned out to be kosher, there was always kiyum.
That's the vote. That's the simen. In other words, wherever Gedolei Yisrael saw, Chachmei HaTorah saw, that a movement is appearing and it's weakening. You know, I can tell you why it was that for a certain tkufa, there was an issur. Today it's a little lighter. There was an issur for hundreds of years on learning Kabbalah. Because it led to certain aberrations, which led, we'll explain it soon when we get to this Sabbatarian movement, which seemed to be used almost as an excuse for what is called, what's called in Jewish history, antinomianism. It was used ki'ilu as if, well, this is the tachlif, you don't have to worry about the halacha. So they fought that too. So then, there were times when up to 40 years there was an issur. I don't know if anybody removed that issur. But many of those who learn Kabbalah today and spread it hold, I don't know enough to say whether it was ever removed. But there are many who start spreading, have been spreading Kabbalah ideas and Kabbalah teaching.
Maybe
Rabbi Shlomo said it's okay. Okay, I don't know. I mean, I'm poshetam. But there was a time when that's what it seemed to be leading to. So Chachmei Yisrael said, cut. We're not going to let that in. Even though it had in its Yisoides, it had so much Kedusha. So wherever you see that any movement which comes ki'ilu to strengthen the Jewish people as it faces new challenges, any movement which became a supporter, which ended up strengthening kiyum mitzvahs, was treated with, was given a better reception, and was even given yiras hakovod and harotza and askoma as time went by. About any movement about which there was a doubt about this, there was a standoffishness. And any movement where they saw that at mamish, it's harming kiyum mitzvahs be Yisrael, so there was a backlash against the whole thing. This is a general clout, yeah?
Sometimes the state of position that is removing themselves from it can harm more than it can heal.
Spell that out a little bit.
In other words, by removing, if they would maintain a shaykhus to the movement which it was starting up, that is, if Gedolei Yisrael would maintain that shaykhus, then they could influence it more.
I'll tell you, it. I claim, you know, who has real knowledge, who looked into the skies on these matters, this only HaKadosh Baruch Hu could judge. But I once heard from Eliyahu Kitayv Alav HaShalom the following words, and it stuck with me. This was shortly, it was right after the last war. He spoke then in America in a certain place, and he was asked something about where were the Gedolim. And he said, if I had to do it all over again, and if I had to be wrong with the Chofetz Chaim, I still would rather be wrong with the Chofetz Chaim. We don't know. It's hard to accept the idea that the Rav Chachmei HaTorah in any given generation are wrong. HaKadosh Baruch Hu may have kindness to this or that Godel. It's not our business. We can't judge that. Why did you do this way? Why did you think that way? The Hanhoga of Klal Yisrael is not based on infallibility, and we are not the judges. You see, in Halacha, there's a system of decision-making. In Inyonim, that have to do, you know, it's the Agoda side of Torah, that have to do with reading the handwriting of the Hashgacha. In those Inyonim, as long as there's a Hastoresponim of Golos, we are too small to be able to judge that. And anybody who wants to hear a wonderful example of what I've been trying in my weak way to say, take a look at that famous Ma'amer of Rav Dessler and the Michtam Eliyahu on the 9 years that elapsed between the time when Mordechai Tzadik was condemned and the time when everybody, like Klal Yisrael, because you're putting us all in danger with your fanaticism, and 9 years later it turned out that he was right. Facts are not in. And anybody who tells you that the facts are in about any of the, especially the modern Tekufa, these were wrong, these were right, that's child's talk. In these inyonim, I'll tell you what I do. If I see that in a given inyon the consensus of the Rav Lom Da'atoyer in the world, where there is a consensus, where 90% of them say, this is how we think about this inyon, I say that, I can't say it for anybody else, I say that I'm too small, and I believe most of us would say the same thing, or all of us would say the same thing. Kibetz a paskin, and to say we're smarter than all of them, because that's what we saw in a series of essays or in a series of books. That's what it looks like to us. I would recommend to anybody who has the heart for it, in the Sforim that were published, either authored by the present Rebbe of Slonim, or published by him, or edited by him, there's one, Zichron Kodesh, which is like a little sefer like this. Part of it is a biographical sketch of the last Lama Rebbe who died in his early 30s, the Mois Kedoshim, Shem Yinkum Domer. But the major part of it is a mamer on the last, on this last Holocaust, which anybody who reads it won't be able to sleep. This I have to tell you. You can't sleep after that. But he says things over there that the early Israel did not want to say publicly, and he says them. He says them, and he says them with great power, but you have to read them. You have to first say a few Mizmorot Tehillim, that the heart should be pure, and the mind should be pure, and then you have to sit down and know that you're not just reading a book, and then you have to go through it 2, 3, 5 times, and you'll begin to hear how we are taught by our rabbis to think about these inyanim. It goes deep. I assure you that Rav Kook himself, or Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, Zecher Shneim Levracha, if they were around today looking at the scene, they wouldn't use all the easy phrases that are used today, you know, in the popular press on this thing. They saw a lot more deeply. And it isn't on these silly phrases that we banter around day and night, the Havas Yisrael and love of Zion, and isn't Israel primary and Yeshiva Oretz. They would have looked at all this talk like baby talk. They saw it from infinitely higher perspectives. So I say again, great as they were, we don't judge. They were great. But there was a consensus of the Chachma Torah in the last two generations that went different. And I don't know whether we can do better, any of us, by saying, it seems to me that the 10% were right, because I read such and such in the record today. We don't know the record yet. How old is the Medina? 40 years, right? Who won the debate? I don't want to go into that again. I want to stay away from that. I'm content to say we don't know. But in the Lamase, wherever there is a consensus or a near consensus, Yirei Hashem, are not going to be judged Achamei Veschem Shana negatively if they follow the consensus. And to say, you know, we see that they made a mistake, it's a kinder talk, it's a baby talk. Chamoza made mistakes, and these didn't make mistakes. Chavitz Chaim made mistakes, and this one didn't make mistakes. Chazon Ish didn't see, and these did see. All the Chachma Torah. If they all didn't see, so the Rabbanu Shalom said, don't see. So whom are we attacking? We're attacking him. say that the old Yehuda Rebbe, Imre Emes, who was brother, one of the three or four ranking Gedolim of the last door, said once about this very, very few words, but it's from Himmel nicht gewesen. The sky, but nicht gewollt, I mean, no, Menashemayim, they didn't want that we should see. So that we're going to go attack this one or that one. Or we know better. I mean, I want to get away from that whole linear. Al Kaponim, we can get back without entering too much in detail into the present, to one general principle. We can say like this: Jewish history again and again demonstrates the following. Any movement within the Jewish people which ended up buttressing Kiyama Mitzvahs B'Yisrael, you'll find out that simultaneously that was the simen and the test, of its reliability, of its truthfulness, even where otherwise it looked like it was departing from earlier norms, but it ended up not departing from earlier norms. Any movement which didn't abide, or which didn't have that characteristic, fell out. Now, I want to get into our Indian language. Yeah?
What did the Chassam Sofer mean when he said Parashas Minotaurus?
What the Chassam Sofer meant was that... I'll give you an example. He lived at a time of emancipation. That was the beginning of the... Well, not quite the beginning, but after the beginning of the beginning. And he saw that the doors were opening to a lot of things for Jews. The big question was, to what extent in the area of Rishus, in the area of the permitted, I'll give you examples, should the Kehillahs and the Rabbonim go along with adjusting Jewish life to the challenges and demands and offers, what was being offered by the New Age. Should they, for instance, stop, or should they all start talking only pure German? Because that jargon of theirs, that half Yiddish that they spoke, half German, was ghettoizing them. Should they, for instance, should Rabbanei Yisrael be given a basically different education than they were given till then? Should they institute a certain type of decorum? And because Jewish young people were beginning to appreciate the music of the surrounding world, should the Nusach HaTfilah and the Negines be modernized? Should they be made to sound more appealing to what was then a contemporary modern ear? These are only small examples. Should they embark, because it was now becoming possible and challenging and most possibly worthwhile to do a lot of business with the Goyisha world, should they start looking for kol minei kulis in the Yonim of Kashvis and Shabbos to facilitate, to make easier the intermingling of the Jew and the non-Jew? About all of these in Yonim, the Chassam Sofer said, that was his great slogan, it was only a... So he said, Chodosh HaSaminatech, we'll stick where we were. And he forgave that famous moshel about the son of the king, who had been expelled from the palace, and for a long while after that, the king kept sending him, little bits of some help here and there, and then finally he sent down some engineers and architects to build him a house, and then the prince started crying because that meant he wasn't bringing him home. So Chassam Sofer then said, "We on the one hand welcome the new house that's being built for us in Golus, but we cry over the fact that this seems to be a simon and a signal that we're not about to be brought back home. Things are being made too sweet and too easy." Shem Shafal Hirsch had a different approach. But he also tried to safeguard Yerushalayim despite his modernity of outer lavush. So the big debate that then emerged was how far and wide could that shita be applied? Would it still produce the great Talmid HaChachamim? Now, the Chassam Sofer paid a price for that. The price that he paid was, and he was deeply distressed over it, a lot of sipurim about Chassam Sofer of his all the years of his end of his life. I'll give you, before I come to this, I don't want to go too far afield, one example. In 1821, before the emergence of the Reform Movement, Chassam Sofer was ready to okay some kind of formal rabbinical training, some form of an Orthodox rabbinical seminary. But the moment reform appeared, he cut that. Because he saw that certain other, it would be used for certain other purposes. This is not the time and place to go into that. But the Chassam Sofer was very sensitive to the New Age, but he held that the best we could do was business. He was ready to go along with a certain integration going out of the ghetto, but he was not ready to come out of, let's call it, cultural isolation. And he held that the line of defense had to be to keep the Kehillahs intact. He himself was not the one who implemented the separation of the Orthodox and the Reform communities. That was his son, the Ksav Sefer, in 1871. It was finally 71 that it happened. But he set the tone for that. And he said, in effect, no accommodation, no compromise. There were others who tried. There is about this. I have to take just another moment to give you a little bit of a historical tidbit on this matter. The Meir Shapiro Zatzal once traveled through much of Europe when he was organizing, he was planning to build Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin. So he visited, among other places, he wanted to see Torah models. Went to Pressburg, and he looked at Kehillas Pressburg four generations later. Right in the time of Rabbi Kiva Sefer already. After some Sefer, Sav Sefer, Shevet Sefer, Rabbi Kiva Sefer. And he's looking at the city. He's looking at its yeshiva. It still was the leading yeshiva of Central Europe, but the Kehillah was a Kehillah Kedosha, come up without compare. And then he went to Prague, the Maidabi Yehuda city. The Maidabi Yehuda was just a little bit older, a little bit before the Chassam Sofer. He goes to Prague, and he wrote an article then that made history. It was entitled, it was written in Yiddish, but it was translated since,
Tale of Two Cities,
Pressburg and Prague. And he said when he came to Pressburg, so on every street he saw the Chassam Sofer alive. He saw tens and tens of Mekomos HaTorah. The whole city was Molei. The Chassam Sofer was alive. And the Maid of Yehuda was smaller. Who would he judge? He goes to Prague, and he wants to see the Jewish Prague. So they take him, they show him the clock over the Altnoy Shul. It has Hebrew numbers, the clock. And then they take him to the Maral's Kever. And then they show him that the city has certain sort of museum setups to safeguard the Jewish antiquities. He says, "Well, I want to see Prague." And then he writes, he came to the conclusion when he studied it that the Chassam Sofer held the line, and then the Yehuda's Talmidim held that for the sake of peace, you have to make accommodations. You have to save that famous, you have to yield part to save the whole. So they kept yielding part until there was nothing left to save.
And
I said that the price that the Chassam Sofer paid was that he had to cut off, in effect, from the Kehillahs a major part of Hungarian Jewry. And they went the other way. In other words, the price that the Chassam Sofer paid was that he saved the integrity of the Kehillahs, but he lost a major part of Hungarian Jewry.
Went
the other way. Because you should see, by the way, letters that were sent to him before he came to Pressburg by a number of young leaders, young Gevirim, who were afraid that he was going to do what he was going to do. They sent him letters about the things that you can't do in Pressburg in this modern age. I think he came, I don't know if it was in 1801 that he came, or was it in 1804? I forget which year it was that he came to Pressburg. He wanted to come 1796, and there was a fire in Mattersdorf, so he came a few years later. So on the way there, they write to him, "This is a modern age. Don't you think," they write to him, "Rabbeinu, we want to follow you, but don't you imagine that you're going to be able to implement in a modern city like Pressburg all of your old notions that boys and girls can't take walks? You know, you're not going to keep our women from being holchim," he meant metailim, leruach hayom, whatever that meant. "And then you're going to come with all of your tzniyas business, with levushim, with this, with that, and you're going to come to a modern city like Pressburg in the modern age of the early 1800s, and you're going to institute all of your chumras over here. Then you should know that we have a lot of money that backs, that's the basis of the whole Kehillah." They write this to him openly. The letter is printed. "And we will fight you to the end. And we have a word with the government." And they're not going to go along with, you know, rebuilding this old ancient fanaticism again over here. We know what happened later. But Al Kaponim, Kacho Yahama, and I'm talking for in a fragmentary way. I don't want to get away from our inya, because there isn't much time left. And with this in mind, what was the specific background from which the movement of the Baal Shem Tov sprang? What was it a response to? I'll give it to you now as briefly as I can. The middle 1600s, one side of the Jewish world, Shabsa Tzvi, false messianism, a result in part of a great desperate yearning on the part of individuals and groups and movements, and he at the head, who came out of the expulsion of Spanish Jewry. That expulsion led to a near Yiddish. A lot of people turned to Torah Sasod to try to find out, you know, how and when will Mashiach come. Tried to turn, many of them with great Kedusha, to Dveikus Bashem, to bring the Geula closer. That was one of the reasons, a faster, one of the reasons for the attempt to reinstitute Smicha, was that many of the Golei Sforat, who had been Maranos, felt that they wanted a Masa Bezdin to administer Malkus for them, and they couldn't attain Tshuva otherwise. That was behind it, and it had other ramifications later. But from all sides, there was a desperate desire to bring about the Geula quickly. I'm doing it in very brief overall strokes. The great negative mass certainly was the Shabsa Tzvi movement. I don't want to go into that now, although it needs a lecture. I wish I had it before me. I had the name. Recently a sefer came out, just two or three years ago here in Yerushalayim, written by a great Talmud Chacham, who was not widely known, but mastered the field. Wrote on the whole tkufa of the Shatz, that we should understand today what to be on guard about. How he worked, what happened to him. He wasn't just done a fraud. There was a lot of kedusha in him, and there was a lot of mixing, and he was mixed up, and undoubtedly at certain times in his life he was demented. You know that at the age of 18 he knew Kavah Shatz, Shatz Mesevrei Kabbalah. The Golei Yisrael stood in awe before him in certain periods. There was a suspicion once, yeah, he could fast for days on end, go through kol mine ascetic lifestyle, his nagus, without, and at the same time without losing weight, balbosa, radiant, always. He had such a radiant appearance. Beyond that, that also it caused a lot of people to misread him or to follow him. There was a time when he had an extraordinary fragrance of body. A fragrance. An odor of psamim. And people suspected him that he was simply, you know, he was using perfume. So he was once challenged. So he invited a certain doctor into his private room, and he completely undressed. And he said to him, look and see if there's anything on me. And then he said what he said. This was not stam an ordinary fraud. There was a great tragedy in it. What we need to remember from that is that the abuse, the misuse, abuse that could come from the secret teachings of the Teres HaNista, from Kabbalah, when handled by people who make a misstep, it's like letting an atom explode the wrong way. Don't think that it's stam an inyan of, you know, people are, you know, these people in the yeshivas don't want that the Hebrew University should do them one better by studying Kabbalah. That's atomic power. You're not ready for it, it destroys. You're ready for it, it opens the door to Geula. It's not an inyan of an academic discipline. Ramban writes about his Derech HaEmeson. I have to mention this for you. Derech HaEmes means those inyanim in the Ramban which were out of Kabbalah. He writes about them. Don't try to understand. He writes them, and he writes it to all of us, you know, as if to say, unless you have a masay reish mepiyish, don't try to understand it. And if you think you understand, I'm telling you, you don't understand. That's what he writes about the Derech Emes, wherever he has that. Uncle Ponim to come back. That's one side of the Jewish world. It shook up the whole Jewish world. It also, by the way, for a while, unleashed a very powerful tshuva movement. Thousands of Jews went through Ta'anesim and Sigufim and rededicated themselves to Shmiras HaMitzvahs and to Bitochen and threw away all concern for wealth. It had powerful positive effects for a while. There was a thorn locked in there somewhere. One side of the Jewish world. The other side, Polish Jewry did well for two centuries approximately, till about the 1600s. And then, because of the struggle between Russia and Poland, Russia was then emerging in its power. Poland was then much more powerful. Because of the struggle between Russia and Poland, the Jews fell victim to the whole Khmelnytsky disaster. Part of those struggles were centered in the Ukraine. The Jew was in a very vulnerable position. Even in the good times, he wasn't given stunned freedoms. So he was engineered by the church, even when before the pogrom started, before the massacre started. The church engineered Jews to live as middlemen. Middlemen meant, you know, a Jew can make a buck fast, and the Jew can run a bar for this or that Polish nobleman, and the Jew can find money for lending for governments and for peasants and for farmers and for city people. When the great explosion of hate came on the part of the Ukrainian nobility, and behind them Ukrainian masses of simple peasants, when the explosion of hate against their Polish overlord struck, the Jew was caught in the line of fire because he was seen as the representative of Polish power. And all the Ritzicha, all the Rishis, you know, the Zodon Shebelev that they had in their hearts was poured out over Ukrainian Jewry and part of Polish Jewry. They came almost to Vilna. And then hundreds of communities were destroyed. And what was left after, you know, after that fire, that happened in 1648. What happened after that fire was down, simultaneously with a terrible, terrible, we should never know from it, the terrible disillusionment that hit most of the Jewish world when Shabtai Tzvi ended up an apostate to Islam. So that hope was just crashed after so much effort was put into it, and so much trust and faith was put into it. And on this side, Jews lost their base, and the Kehillahs no longer could revive as they couldn't regain their earlier strength and power and vitality. Jews were impoverished greatly. Their strength, Ba'ena Agoyim, their safety was completely undermined. It led to a terrible crisis of soul all over the Jewish world. It centered mostly all over Europe. That was the background for the appearance of the Baal Shem. That was the inner matzav of the Jews in Poland and in Litva and in the Ukraine. There was no challenge that was open against the keeping of the halacha and the mitzvahs. The chelek of Torah, haniglis, of keeping mitzvahs, remained relatively strong all over these communities. The rabbonim remained in authority. But what's called nishmas d'oraisa, that became weak. There was yish. There was little simchas achayim. There was less and less tikva. There was, as a result, more and more tension. Lashon haras, scandals in the life of the kehillahs, in which important people were involved. Such, because of poverty, such a weakening of the koyach of the rabbonos, that instances began to happen more and more of Rabbanisim being bought through protectia and outright bribe, or not outright bribe, or concealed bribe. In other words, the hands did, the feet did, the body did, but the Neshama was faint. And the Neshama of an individual can become faint if he loses heart and hope, and the Neshama of a klal can also become faint. It's against that background that the Neshama appeared as a Malach Menorah.
I think if I understand the Rav correctly, the point that's being made here, I only want to emphasize it because I think that it's important that has to be made, is that there was an element of serious element of imperfection in the Jewish community at that time.
Bevada. Every one of these movements, by the way, they say imperfection. The question is like this: was it the imperfection of Torah, or was it an imperfection which the Baal Shem wanted to see in his Talmidim as having been triggered by, as having been a function of the tzoras of Golus? So for whatever reason, it needed correction, right?
But I'm asking because there's a tendency to romanticize the earlier period.
I never do. I try to find a balance that we should know what we need to respect and to know the truth. That's why I shy away from easy answers, whatever truth. There was a malaise of spirit. Things went wrong. And I say that Rabbanim had control, but that control over the Shulchan Aruch side of existence. But they lost control over, over the chinuch of Nishmas Hador. At this time, the Baal Shem appeared. It's very fragmentary what I tried to tell you, but I tried to pinpoint what was the real nekuda against which he was working. Now, I mentioned the whole disaster with the downfall of the Shabbatarian movement. I have to mention here too that one of the effects of that, one of the results was that there was a powerful resistance to the limud of Pnimiyas HaTorah, of Kabbalah, that developed as a result of what happened with Shabbat Tzvi and his people. In other words, all the Chachmei Yisrael then said that these limudim are nachlas yechidim, it's for individuals, it's for b'nai aliyah, it's not for the mass of people, and they just cut it out. The Baal Shem took, you might say that the essential achievement of the Baal Shem, and he took a tremendous risk, was a tremendous tightrope walk, was that he took hold of that matziv, and in effect, what comes out, I don't know that he ever said it in these words, what comes out of his work and that of his Talmidim, was that he said, maybe these or those simple Jews can't learn Sifrei Kabbalah, can't put it into the hands of every tailor and every shoemaker. But the teachings of the Kabbalah, mediated properly, can renew the hearts and the Simchas Halev and the Betochen. They went wrong because they were doichakim esakeitz. But we are going to start teaching Jews not to be doichakim esakeitz, but to be worthy of the keitz. It's been said that both the Goan and after Rabbi Yisrael and the Baal Shem, they really are pirushim on the Bereisa de Rav Pinchas ben Yoeh. They both have a deep inner relation to the Ramchal. Because what is the Bereisa of Rav Pinchas ben Yoeh? It's a whole lineup. It says, Torah meivel edei zehirus, and zehirus meivel edei zerizus, and further until you get to Ruach HaKodesh. Now, I think I once mentioned this to you. Do any of us know in the last few thousand years of a school system, of a chinuch system, which said, we're not just about to produce Eilach HaYidin, and Lomdim, and Tzadikim, and Goyinim. We want to head Klal Yisrael towards a renewal of Ruach HaKodesh, that we should develop again the Kalim, that we should deserve that Ruach HaKodesh should start functioning within us. So far cry that from the Chikas HaKetz, but it does try to move us closer to the Ketz. The Baal Shem undertook that. Everything that he did, whether tonight or in Yetzir Shem, or the next time we meet, I'll try to spell that out if not in total detail, but at least with sufficient clarity. But you should hear that everything he did comes from this Nekuda. He wanted to revive a chinuch that would move Klal Yisrael towards Ruach HaKodesh. And on the way, Simcha and Chavis Achaim and Pitochim. And I'm going to study him and I have a Zrayim. And Kalois HaNefesh and Tfilah emphasized centrally as a means to coming to Bitlayesh. They say that, I haven't seen this mixed out, that Baal Shem Tov once said on the Pasuk Nafshi Yotza Bedabroi, that if a Jew, when he says a word of tefillah, is still conscious, even with kavona, is conscious of himself still. He's saying this word, great kavona, Baruch Atu Hashem. And he knows that he's still around. And he still has an ear for some noise that's bothering him. There's noise, a kid just made some noise. And he's got kavona, but he's aware. He's aware that there's a child making noise. And he himself is still around. He consciously hasn't forgotten. He hasn't become unconscious of himself. He hasn't become swallowed up in that word. It wasn't yet nafshi yotza bedabroi. So he used to say, that's not yet the tafkid of the matzor of tefillah. Now we're very far from that. But I knew yid who tried to daven like that. And there are yidin like that, not far from here. In Yerushalayim and HaKadosh, there are Jews who still daven. Well, whose aspiration is to that? It's a minute, trivial example almost of that whole central principle. He wanted to revive Ruach HaKadosh B'Yisrael. Now, give you a further example, push it from his name. I want to get in a minute at least into, you know, a brief survey of his life. He was called Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem. That was called Rabbi Yisrael, the name Yisrael itself, that he was given that name, is also a mark of the Hashgacha. He's a miniature Rabbi Yisrael. Baal Shem. There were other Baal Shem there. What did a Baal Shem mean in that Kufa? A master of the name. What's a master of the name? Those who used to not just learn Kabbalah for Havona, for Hasogah, and for Dveikus Bashem, but who wanted to use it with its atomic power, that's called practical Kabbalah, and they wanted to achieve certain things through Kabbalistic activities, they used to write Kameyas. Somebody's in trouble. This woman has had difficulty, or she has difficulty bearing a child, or giving birth to the child. Here's a Kameyas, some Malachim, names of Malachim are written over here. You place it on her or somebody else. He has this kind of trouble, this Yeled, this father. Here's a Kameya. And in this Kameya, there are tzirufim of Shemus and of Malochim, and it's supposed to miraculously bring about a Yeshua. Now, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem, you know what was written in his Kameyas? Only one of the two following, either Yisrael ben Eliezer or Yisrael ben Sarah, his mother's name. Nothing else. When he was asked, he was told that the Kameyas he gives are based on only two things, tefillah, his and the tefillah of the people involved. Pinchas Kovetzer said about that, that in that case, since he used the whole Indian so differently than it was used by others, why did that name stick to him? All the others are come out forgotten. There was a Rabbi Yoel Baal Shem, there was a Rabbi Adam Baal Shem. The picture that you see everywhere as the picture of the Baal Shem is not authentic. That picture most likely is the picture of the Baal Shem of London. It's come out proven. Not come out, it's proven. That's not a picture. Al Kaponim, why was he called Baal Shem? So Pinchas Koretzer said the following. You hear what he did, that sort of... He lived in the sphere. He was essentially a proponent of Kabbalah Sa'ari, the Ari HaKadosh. He's a commentator and he provides an exposition and an application of Kabbalah Sa'ari, but with certain different emphasis and different approaches. Why is he called Baal Shem, says Rabbi Pinchas Koretzer? Because when a person gets sick, so they give him medicine. And if he starts losing consciousness, and the doctor says it's important to keep him awake, so they start calling to him. They try to keep him awake by calling to him. And if that doesn't help, somebody who's one of his loved ones will go over and shout into his ear his name, because that's what he's going to be most lastingly aware of, even when most of his consciousness is gone already, if he still has something of consciousness left, he'll respond to his name somehow. If he doesn't respond to that either, so he said that, Pinchas Chorot said that in the door of the Baal Shem Tov, East European Jewry was in a matzev of like that sick person who had completely lost all consciousness, now with the ability to respond to the call of the Shechina through Torah, through mitzvahs, through lomdas, even though they're doing it outwardly. You know, the body is there, but the neshama response, the mental and emotional response isn't there. So he somehow had the koyach. He knew by what name to call Klal Yisrael. He knew what to whisper in its ear. He knew how to awaken its emunah. He knew how to not let it become unconscious completely. You hear? Now, his life. I'm going to try to stick only to what's known more or less historically. There's very little known about his childhood. What is known is not in the Kodesha. It's Agodas Am. Every one of those little tidbits that have come down somehow with different Nesuos come down to us from the Shifchei HaBaal Shem Tov. You hear? Shifchei HaBaal Shem Tov was a sefer that was written about 50 years after his Ptira. Yeah, but I just see that. Let me close this one. Yeah. 50 years later, there are different versions of it. And from grandchildren of his and Talmidim, there are certain sort of discrepancies between them and the Shifchei HaBaal Shem Tov. Every one of those semi-legendary accounts has at least a Musa truthfulness in it. That it has. It teaches something. It's a Musa Haskel. But since we don't know, we don't really know about the first few years of his life, so I'm leaving that. Whoever wants to read up as much as is known, of course there is the Shifchei HaBaal Shem, which is a Mekai Rishon, but I want you to take down just the name of several, two of those Sforim I have with me, of several Sforim which are excellent, in my estimate, excellent historical reconstructions. They were written by people who weren't outsiders, they were written by people who weren't Stam enemies or critics, but they were also written by people who weren't blinded, you know, by their own Hislavus. They sifted what they studied, they wrote carefully, and as close as you see, nobody could write objectively. You're either going to be a friend, a devotee, you're in such a case, either you're going to sympathize with or you're going to sympathize against, or not sympathize, or you'll have an antipathy. These people are not neutral, but the names that I'm going to give you are basic for an understanding of this movement, that it shouldn't come only through people like Yashar Shalom. Rabban Markus Achasidus. Rabban Markus was a German Jew, a Hamburg Jew, close earlier in his years to his middle age to the world of Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, Rabbi Shamsher Ephraim Hirsch, who went to Krakow. He became a Talmud of the Teferet Shleima and of the Sar Sholem, the first Bel Zerav, and he became the most brilliant exponent of Chassidish thought and much of Chassidish Masoira, because he still met in Krakow a son of the Moav Shamish, and the Moav Shamish still had direct connections with Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov. The source, which is for again, I'm exempting from this, by the way, there's another source which serves, I would say, not just superficially but deeply as a source of tradition of another Chassidish movement in Chabad. The Maseres of Chabad, at least, was very carefully kept. So there's a whole series of Sforim that they have. The problem over there is that when you go past the Rav Baal HaTanya and you come to the Baal Shem himself and the Maggid, there are divergent pictures, divergent views, depending on which of the Talmidim of Hashem, which the other Masorah came down from. What I'm talking about is now is about the Masorah of, in general, of Chassidus. And I'm not including in this the particular movement of Chabad. It has its Masorahs. Now, Rabbi Markus, Rabbi Yekusiyo Kamelhar, the Dor Dayo. outstanding. Rabbetzala Lando Hechel Habesht. No? Rabbi Kusil, Kutil Kamelhav. He's also famous for another work. But, it's just not extant anymore. HaTalmud Madoy HaTevel. He brought together all the sources of scientific knowledge and knowledge in every field of human learning and study that are found in Shas. It's a massive achievement. Somehow it was never reprinted. I don't know why. What? No. It's not a small sefer. It's not too thick like this, but like this. HaTalmud Madoy HaTevel. There might have been others, but if there is, what? Yeah, whatever is found on psychology and on chemistry and on biology, whatever you are on aesthetics, whatever you can think of, everything that you know that has a designation in Western culture, he categorized it, and he cites with some comments all the Makaras of Shas. It's tremendous, but here we're concerned with something else now. More recently, it's called Hechel Habesht. He's in Yerushalayim. He wrote a lot of Sforim, both. He also wrote Hagoyen HaChosed Mevilna. Eliezer Steinman, who started out his life as a Mapainik, ended up at Baal Tshuva, and wrote a 10-volume series called Be'er Achsidus. It's heavy Hebrew, but it's worth it. It's worthwhile. Okay, this is essential. There's much more. Not his life.
I want to mention this as the name of a sefer for those who are more comfortable in English. Most, as the Rav alluded to, most of us written in English is unacceptable for reasons that are self-evident. But there's a book that tells the same story of Aaron Marcus. I mean, a parallel story. It's written by a fellow. It's translated from the Hungarian, I think, into English. It's called by a fellow named Yuri Langer.
He became a Bel Zechose. He was a Bel Tshuva.
A Boy in Prague, is that the name?
A Boy in Prague.
A Boy in Prague.
And nine and a half, what else did he write?
Nine gates.
To the Hasidic Mystery. That Yuri Lange. Oh, what a stipple there is.
So for those who
came about Tshuva, wanted to marry a daughter of a Yare Chosid. The Rabbi said no. But he was a Adam Kodesh. I don't know what happened to him at the end. That would Bevadai be reliable. Because he wrote with great faithfulness.
J-I-R-I.
Yuri Lange. I've never seen it, but Nine Gates, that I did see. Now, others. You know, one of my Talmidim, I don't know how successful he will be, has just finished in manuscript Yitzchak Dorfman. He just finished a manuscript on the Baal Shem and five of his leading Talmidim, which is going to be published soon. She did over there in our hometown over the last year or two. So that when that comes out, there'll be something that is not going to be at the highest level, but it's going to be semi-popular, semi-scholarly. Now, we have to stop, but his life, as much as we know about it. He was born, Baal Shem was born approximately Tof Nun Ches, equivalent to 1698. Nifter Tof Kuf Chof, 1760, Misparam Shavuos. The tales of his child not historically confirmed. Now I want to do this very concisely. He was born in a town called Akup. There's some dispute among scholars as to which Akup it was. Both of these places are places that are between Moldavia, Ukraine. They are between, like at a meeting point between Poland, Russia, Romania, Hungary. It's a dead center, a village. As a little child, he must have been 4 or 5 years old when his father was Nifter. His father told him, "Don't be afraid, Hashem itcho. Don't be afraid of anything. If you remember that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with you, you'll have no fear." The townspeople provided him with a malamed, put him into a cheder. He kept pulling towards his bodhidus. He wanted to be alone with nature. His contemplation, his Hashmana, even as a child. They made him then a Behelfer, an Ozer, an assistant to a Melamed. All of this is a lot that's symbolic. Two little stories. He used to lead children to Chayder and love them, kiss them, sing with them. And once a Shaget started throwing rocks at the children, frightened them badly. So the Baal Shem said whatever he said to the Shagets, and the Shagets became rooted to his place and lost his language instantly. Couldn't talk. I started sinking into the ground. And family came running, and the Baal Shem made him promise that he was not going to harm Jewish children again. And then he brought him back. Another instance, some kind of a sorcerer turned out to be a human being at the end, who dressed himself in the skins of animals, danced about, frightened children, and became very frightened. Seemed to have, you know, beastly power. The Baal Shem fearlessly struck him on the head. He fell dead. Then, when people went over to see what was happening, what this was, they saw it was a person with some kind of, I don't know, it was a bear skin, whatever it was on. By day, they couldn't get him learning, but at times they would catch him learning at night. He used to learn through the nights. He then, a while later, went to the town of Brod, jumping ahead here. No, even before that. There were a lot of Jews then in villages. In these small villages, because as a result of the pogroms of 1648, they felt unsafe and insecure in the cities, so they went to the land. And in the land, many of them had bars, and developed, again, private relationships with this or that goy, this or that poets, Christian noblemen. Their existence was a pitiful one, but they were in a state of sort of a semi-underground, semi-hiding, and it was there that a lot of ignorance developed. They were pious, they were Balei Amunah, but very, very unlearned. The Baal Shem was mitztofef. He wandered about these villages. When he was 18, some kind of an experience happened to him, which was doime to Gilo Elio, and he then came to feel, when he was 18 years old, that he had a tafkid for the sake of bringing about a Yeshua for Klal Yisrael. I'm putting it as briefly as I can. The age of 18. He then learned Shechita, and he became a Shechet in a town called Kashelevitz. He was married through a minyan, I haven't got the time to tell you now, but it was extraordinary how it happened, to a sister of a very great Talmud Chacham. That Talmud Chacham is mentioned as having been corresponded, Charles Achuvis, with the Knight of Yehud. It was a gordel, in fact. He ended up in Eretz Yisrael, at Gerash and Kittel. That brother-in-law desperately fought against the Shidduch. How that Shidduch came about is not for tonight. Ashgochan. But the wife of the Baal Shem quickly sensed that he was not an ordinary person and decided to go with him. And he couldn't stay in his brother-in-law's house and town. That brother-in-law was one of the Chachmei Brod. I have to tell you what Brod was then. Brod is a city in Galicia which had a cloise. A cloise, it was like a shtibu. Before the Hasidic movement, there were here and there such rare places where only Balei, you know, Biktamer Chachomim, some of them were Kabbalim, learned. The Brod cloise had a concentration at one time for some tens of years as a group setting of the greatest Talmid HaChachamim in Europe. The Noi Debi Yehuda was a chaver, and that was a kerev and German in that close. And there were a few tens like him there. That all became famous. And this Rabbi Yashin Kitever was one of the Chachma close in Brod. There were Gdol Olam there, Rabbi Chaim Yashin Magolius, what's his name of his sefer? You know, before the Mishnah Berurah became famous, he was printed. The Yad Ephraim is from him,
And there's a famous Sefer on before Rosh Hashanah, we all learn it.
The
Mat Ephraim. That's he was Gaon Olam. The Ephraim's Alma Magoyis, and he's also one of the Chachma Akbaris. And Hashem comes to this place and starts drying Zech over there, and nobody knows what to do with him. He's different than others. He's bigger than they thought, they see, but they don't know. And all of a sudden they hear he organized a minyan. That was the first Chassidim Shtibu, in Brod, with a small group of Talmidim, and the Nusach they hear is not Nusach Ashkenaz. It's some form of the Nusach Ari, what we call today Nusach Svar, the Chassidish Nusach Svar. So they examined him, and it seems that when they found that his Kameis did not have any Tzichufim of Shemus and Malochim, and they observed that he was Molei Yerushalayim, and so were the people around him. And these were people who had acquired already a certain base in learning Torah Sanhedrin, so they didn't fight him, even though they were misnagdim to him. But they started, at first they didn't fight him on this basis alone, that they held that he was a Yerai Shemayim, and more than this somehow doesn't come down from the records. I mentioned that he was a Malamed for a while, or an Ozer to a Malamed, a Shoichet. He also had a great interest, I have to jump ahead, in Shabbos, and particularly in Erevim. And from that period in his life, there comes down a wonderful vort of his. Every one of his remarks was like a little dot, and a big world around it. There's a pasuk in Chavakuk, Bezaam Titzad Eretz. You hear, the land will march with storm. So he said, Bezaam Titzad Eretz. Zam stands for Zvicha, Erev and Mikveh. He held that the Shechita needed a lot of correction. He held that many of the Tzoras wore a kind of an onesh for Kilkulim in the Matzav HaShechita. And he instituted a new form of preparing knives, sharp knives, which spread later from the Chassidish world to the whole Misnagdish world as well. And he himself was a shochet, and he started a certain emphasis or a certain insistence in the whole Chassidish world to this day. A shochet has to be a Yerei Shemayim, not only a technical expert. There are many in Yonam in it, because they held that a pikabola, a person who is ready to kill, wants to be a shochet. You have to be chayshet whether his neshama is not from Madin. So you see, there's a certain kind of personality which is strong. It tends towards physical gevura, towards dinim, and if it's not handled the right way, it can become ritzicha. So the simon of a shoychet had to be a Yerei Shemayim. And one more thing, especially that a shoychet to be accepted in the Chassidish world, in addition to exceptional Yerei Shemayim, had to stand out, which was not the case before. Okay, he knows how to do a kol shoychet. That, plus, they tested him, is he about stock and about chesed? If he was not about chesed, they used to say like this, old. The first Deres of Chassidim used to say about Shochtim that if they would catch him as being too tough, they would say, he's not a Shochet, he's a Ratzayach. In order that the Shochet shouldn't be a Ratzayach, should be a Shochet. A Kaler, old Yiddish, it hasn't been used in 150 years. It's the Yiddish, the old Yiddish for a killer. Kuf, Yud, Yud, Lamed, Ayin, Reish. A Kaler. Yiddish, old Yiddish, a Ratzayach. Bezan, Titzad Eretz, Zvicha, Ayin is Erevin. And Eretz, I'm sorry, and Mem stands for Mikveh. This I have to come back to. He came to feel that these three in Yonim needed a lot of emphasis. And one more thing. He also held that the Tzura of Chazones, which had then become popular, was ruining the Bat HaTfilah. And in the Chassidish world, one of the first things that was done when it became a movement, they were Mavir. They didn't want Chazonim of the type that, you know, cantors, professional singers. So they wanted Adarabo, that was one of, he wanted that the tefillah should have beauty. So the beauty of Chassidish and Negina became in time, and there were extraordinary about tefillahs who were developed in the Chassidish tradition, but not Chazonis. Not repeating a word, not extra, what do they call it, coloratura, they call that. You know, the trembling of the Chazonim will go, up and down. No poses. Al Kaponim, these in Yonim, he started emphasizing a great deal. By the time he also for a while he's abroad. For 7 years is Baidadus. What did he want to do with this? Is Baidadus two things. With this is Baidadus, he wanted to attain Yiras Hashem, and he wanted to attain Dveikus and Ahavas Hashem. After that, at the age of 36, he became Nisgale, and he became revealed and started developing a larger following. Here, what remains to be mentioned right now is that then he started to undertake a number of things, Nisios, trips to different places. And in this, it seems that he held all Chassidim had a Masoros that he wanted to follow in the footsteps of Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi, at a time when Klal Yisrael needed rebuilding, wandered about from city to city instead of waiting for everybody to come to him. Nisios. Then he also started developing, in addition to special emphasis on tefillah, what's called a shulchan, the tish. That there should be dibuk chaverim together with a manhig. Dibuk chaverim. He also taught people how to eat. I'm not explaining. I mean, again, today it's already all just, it's a nusach, it's an imitation. But he taught achila of a different kind. And his house was always open to the poor, and unlike what had been the hisnagos of the Rabbana before, and another, they all were Balei Chesed, but the Chol Mevakshei Hashem, people started coming to ask for Eitzes and Hadrocha. They didn't then ask, like today, I have troubles, give me an Eitz. It started out with Eitzes and Avodas Hashem. How do I overcome this or that Pagam and Amidah? How do I correct myself in this area, in that area? How do I learn how to daven properly? How do I learn to learn properly? He started emphasizing Ahavas Yisrael and the sense of limit zchus over the dor and over every Jewish part of Klal Yisrael. And Klal Yisrael together is Bevada Yashtem Chalek Yerem Abo. It's an emphasis of his. Avi Yisayman, Chnosis Kala, did a lot for that. He did not favor the style of the Magidim then, who spoke very bitter Musa. He developed a type of Magidus which was designed to speak with Ahav, not to speak with bitterness and with harshness. Again, not to paint the Gehenim. There's Bevada Yamam, and there's no question there was a Mam in Ashgocha and his Chavoinish, but he held that the dog could not handle that kind of admonition, that kind of Tochocha. What about Talmidim? He had 60 Talmidim who were Gedolei Yisrael. The most famous among them in the world of Nigla too, were the Mezritch HaMagid, who was a big Goyen, the Baal HaToldos, Rabbi Yashin Kitevi, and the Mendel of Vitebske. Mendel of Vitebske was the Rebbe of the Rav Baal HaTanya. These four were among the biggest Lamdim in his. And there was another Rabbi Meir Margulis, who wasn't a member of the inner core, but was very close to him. Rabbi Meir Margulis was one of the Goyen of Poundim. Bishita, Rav Meir Margulis. He was one of the Goyim of that age. His Talmidim, the Mezritch HaMagid, he already had a number of Talmidim who were outstanding in Nigla as well as in Nistar. But I purposely mentioned those who were great in Nigla. The Baal HaFlo, who later was Rav in Frankfurt, and his brother Rav Shmuel of Nikolsburg. These two were among the biggest Goyim in Europe in their age, and they were Talmidim of the Mezritch HaMagid. The Rav Baal HaTanya was the Talmud of the Mezritch HaMagid. Others of lesser fame, but he already had 300 leading Talmidim. From them the movement spread. Hashem was Nifter, as I said, in 1760. According to some, he participated in a fateful debate with Yaakov Frank, whom I have told you about, who tried to revive the Shabbat Tzvi movement in Poland and the Ukraine. He was then spit out. He then became a Christian together with 800 followers. He even suffered a lot from him. And according to some, the Baal Shem was one of three Rabbonim who participated in that vikuach, which was forced upon them by the church and so on. The last words that the Baal Shem said were last seconds of that he was still conscious in this life. Last words he said were, let not the foot of Gava reach me. Now, I see that I can finish what I wanted to say to you about Shabbat, though it's inadequate, because next time I want to get to the Goyim.